This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Peter Donahue about a book of, it's called Three Sides Water, and it's a collection of three short novels. It's hard to, you can't call it a novel. It's not really a collection in a sort of a short story collection. It's kind of bigger than that. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good, David.
Well, it's hard not to ask about this sort of structural question. These three short novels take place in Washington State, all at different times, but basically set in a similar area. But they're not interconnected. They're not three short novels telling put together to create a larger narrative. And my first question to you is, what is it that separates a novel from a novella? Is it an arbitrary distinction? Does it have a meaning?
Well, it did start to have a distinction the more I worked on these. At least for me, it did. I know it's in many ways an arbitrary distinction, but it helped me in composing them to think of this. Because originally I thought of them as, I even make a distinction between a novella and short novel at this point, because I was thinking of three novellas, and they just got longer and longer. And I realized I couldn't even send them out to periodicals that published novellas because they were over the maximum length for novellas at some point. And so they did start to feel like novels in that, and I started to think of what is that distinction, and it kind of paralleled this, for me, the distinction between short stories and novels, that a short story gets at a moment in a character's life, and that moment resonates throughout their life, but really once the story ends, that moment ends, whereas a novel it's really about the life in its entirety, even though the scale of the narrative, the chronology of the narrative might not encompass the whole novel. What's occurring is pivotal to the character's whole life. And that's how I started to see each of these. It was transformative for the character's whole life. The circumstances that they were going through in each of their stories. And I even started to think of the short novels as analogous to the peninsula, which is where they're all set, out on the Olympic Peninsula on the Washington coast. Kind of that they're removed from the larger body, the mainland. They can't quite stand alone. And so they're separate from the larger work, but they're also attached.
And also three sides of the peninsula being three sides, you could look at it from three different directions.
Right. Yeah. And so that coincided very nicely as well.
Well, each takes place in a different time period. Each takes place with a very different main character. When you worked on these, did you work on them? It was the first one that takes place in the kind of 1920s era. Was that the first one you wrote? And then you wrote one about the guy in the 60s, and then the more current one. Were they did you write them in chronological order?
I did pretty much draft them in chronological order. But then it was, several years of working on them all simultaneously, just back and forth. And they did stand alone for a long time. Although I did originally conceive of the book as this kind of triptych of these three that would, as you said, represent the three sides of the peninsula. But they each were independent, but the more I worked on them, the more the voices seemed to complement one another, and the more I saw overlapping themes in them, which I was then able to, I think, work on through the revision process.
Yeah, it is. Now, there's so many questions. It's hard to know where to begin. I read the book in order. So I read, you know, you read starting from the first one. And, you know, I don't want to give away too much of any of the stories to anybody to spoil their reading of them. So there's things that I have to be careful in the way I ask them of you in terms of explaining how they fit together, because you don't want to really give away too much story. In a way, the first one and the third one relate in this, you know, kind of funny way, because the first one is about a woman, young woman, who's connected to a performer, a magician, essentially, or an impresario kind of guy. And the third one is about a man who is fascinated with and sings the songs of Bing Crosby, another entertainer, major figure. So it's sort of, in a way, I saw those as relating to each other, as you said, maybe overlapping a little bit. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that. The first one, the first book, let me see, I have to go back because I can't remember the title, On Rialto Beach, which is, you know, Rialto. Mm-hmm. Rialto, of course, is an old-fashioned word for that often was used for stage theaters and movie theaters.
Right.
And is Rialto Beach a real place?
Well, that's the story I've heard. I used to bring students out there, out to the Olympic Peninsula, and that's where I got the ideas for these stories is during those trips. And we had a forest ranger guide us on Rialto Beach, and she pointed up into the woods when we were in the parking lot there at the state park, at the national park. And she said there used to be a compound up there of this magician from the 1920s. And I think that's all she said. But I was like, really? I have to look into this. And it turned out that it was this man, Claude Alexander Comyn, a pretty famous magician / mentalist from Hollywood, who did build a compound up in the woods there just above the beach. And later I went back on my own and poked around among the ruins of the compound. And it's the legend is that he did name it after the theaters where he would perform throughout the country.
It has that feel. I'd say that that novel definitely has the feel of, and you captured that feel, I thought, really well, of the kind of West Coast theatrical film milieu, which is a pretty interesting period, you know, in American history, and kind of has a certain exoticism to it. That I thought, yeah. You know, I thought you pinpointed really well.
Well, he's such a crazy figure. You know, he's this impresario, as you said. He's this showman, kind of a charlatan. He had a lot of run-ins with the law. Legend has it that he might have even killed the legendary Soapy Smith up in Skagway, Alaska. He was a rival of Houdini's and kind of had this ongoing feud with Houdini, but he was remarkably successful as well. And he knew a lot of famous people, especially in Hollywood. And so just the idea of him up there on the far northwest coast of the Olympic Peninsula was just intriguing to me. You know, you put this guy who's a mentalist and doing seances and doing mind readings, and you put him in the mystic northwest, in the deep northwest woods, and just across the river from the Creel Indian Reservation, and then just some of the other legendary figures from the area, like John Holsdunk, who's a contemporary of the Iron Man of Ho, who also appears in the piece, and the logging industry. And it was just, I felt like this is I had the makings of a T.C. Boyle novel here, really, with just all the carnival-esque qualities of it. But, you know, I'm not T.C. Boyle, and I'm a little more of a quieter writer. And that's where that narrator, Marguerite Johnson, came in, because he, Claude Alexander Conlin, Mr. C, as he's referred to in the novel, would bring his whole entourage up to this compound, which was several buildings. And he'd bring them up there for the entire summer, pretty much, so he could fish and hunt. And Marguerite was one half of the Nartel twins, which was the stage name for these twins, 21 years old, who were stage assistants and exotic dancers in his act. And so I tell the story through Marguerite.
Right. And of course, she has, and I think we don't want to talk about too much of what happens, but she is the one who experiences the most complex set of events, you know, at the core of that novel. And you sort of, I found at the end of that novel that I kind of would like to know more about her. You know, I think maybe, you know, as a reader, I'd like to see her return and find out what's happened, you know, maybe, when she's older and has lived the rest of her life, it would be interesting to know. It's sort of, remember in the movie, The Titanic, the older woman who's telling the story, you want to know about what it's like later in their lives, after these kind of mysterious events of, you know, long ago in their youth, they had these mysterious events occur, and you want to, you know, what happens after?
Well, it is a voice that's looking back, and she's trying to reckon with the events that happened that summer of 1925 out on that remote beach, and all the things that came into play, you know, including a visit to the Shaker Indian Church over in La Push, where she's confronted by a Tominus man, as he's called. It's a Chinook jargon term for shaman or medicine man. And the seance that she's part of, that Conlin hosts for the wives and daughters of all the timber barons in the region, or the visit by the legendary Harold Lloyd to the compound, and her infatuation with him. And so she is trying to process it all and to deal with it all. In some ways, too, it's all three of the stories really are in many ways they're all kind of coming of age stories in which the characters have to make that final move into adulthood, or one of those big moves into adulthood. You know, coming of age is not just about coming into your majority at 18. It's different stages of our lives, through teens, 20s, and 30s. And that's where each of those characters find themselves, trying to make that next step into adulthood. And for her, especially being a twin, it's about her independence. It's her independence from her twin sister. It's her independence from this man and his enterprise that came into her life when she was 17, and that she's been attached to ever since.
Well, and that actually is a kind of good lead in to talking about the second novel, Fort Worden, which is about, it is another coming of age story. It's a young man who's in this kind of, I guess you would call it, a youth facility. And he's also faced with challenges of maturity, you know, or lack of maturity, and turning himself into a real person, and goes through some experiences, difficulties that force him to confront himself.
Yeah. Yeah. He's in a juvie center. Fort Worden is this beautiful fort up there outside of Port Townsend, on the northeast corner of the peninsula. And it was decommissioned in the 50s. And few people know this, but between 1950 and 1971, it was a juvenile detention center. And afterwards, it became a state park, and now it's a big arts center, really. But for those 15 years, it was the major juvenile center in the state. All kids going to different juvie centers had to come through there to be diagnosed and assessed. But yeah, he's just 16 when he arrives, and you know, it's the end of the 1960s. It's the 70s. It's that the way I think of it, he's in that kind of liminal period between the trauma of 1968 with the assassinations and the rise of the disco era in the mid 70s. It's a kind of to me, I see it as a kind of a period where you know, all those social, some of that idealism of the 1960s was at the same time souring for a lot of people and starting to seem a little quixotic, while at the same time it was starting to take hold in some of our institutions and actually change some of our social mores. And so he's reckoning with the period in this microcosm of the juvenile detention center.
And so it seems like you've placed all of these stories in, I mean, and the third one, of course, does, it takes place mostly in Seattle, although the main characters are from a small, a small town nearby. So you've placed all these novels in real places. And they're all clearly kind of Olympic Peninsula stories. But as you indicated to me before we started talking, this is not where you're from. So I was kind of curious. I wanted to ask you about what attracted you to this area and what kind of brought you to this setting for these books.
Yeah, well, sure. Just a little background. I grew up in New Jersey, just outside of New York. And when I was 16, I delivered a driveaway car from New York to Seattle. I wasn't old enough to get it, but a friend of mine who was 18, he got it, and we drove it together out to Seattle. And I just fell in love with the city, and I had already dropped out of high school, and so a few years later, I ended up moving to Seattle and really made it my home. Ended up going to the University of Washington, meeting my wife there. And one of the apartments I had always, I didn't have a car, so when I lived there, I couldn't get outside the city much, but I had this wonderful apartment that looked out over Puget Sound and across the way to the Olympic Peninsula and the mountains. And it always held such a lure to me, but it was also kind of a scary place, so remote back then, it seemed to me, in the 80s. And plus, my last three novels were set right in Seattle. And so I kind of wanted to get out of the city with this book as well. And as I said, I used to take students there, and that's where I latched on to the story ideas for this book. So you and then the idea of the peninsula, it just intrigued me that there are these three different parts of it, and I wanted to capture all three sides of it.
So the first book is kind of the West, the second book is the North, and the third book the East. Is that really?
Yeah, the Southeast. The third one is set in Shelton, which is a an old mill town, part of the great sawdust empire of that region.
Right, and your main character, he comes from a family that makes its living in the wood industry. You know, he's a mill. Yeah, I don't know what his specific job is. I don't know enough about how it works in the wood wood mills, but he's like a pretty good at what he does. But he really wants to, but he really wants to sing Bing Crosby songs.
He wants to sing Bing Crosby songs because he was raised by his grandma, who was a Bing Crosby fanatic. It always astonishes me how few people know about Bing Crosby today. If you're under 30, you may not even know who he is anymore. But in his day, he was the biggest entertainer out there, and he still holds a lot of the records for sales. And Elvis, the Beatles, One Direction, you name it, they couldn't hold a candle to Bing Crosby in his day for popularity. And so he's raised by his mother and develops this obsession, which is even somewhat of a fetish. And he wants to be a Bing Crosby tribute singer. And so that's why he leaves the family mill and sets off for Seattle, as a lot of young people do in the rural towns out here. You know, they want to escape the provincialism of where they grew up. You know, they see Seattle as that beacon out there. You want to aim for the bright lights, big city. And they want to, do something with themselves. But as it so often happens, the city changes them, but it also challenges them a lot. And, sometimes they go back, sometimes they don't.
Right. But he has an opportunity that most people don't have because of his ability to sing.
Yeah, he's uncannily good at singing, and he sparks a somewhat of a Bing Crosby revival in Seattle. And in some ways, this gave me an opportunity to do a bit of a send-up of Seattle, which, these days it can be a pretty trendy place.
Yeah, like a little bit like Portland, maybe.
Yeah, a little bit like Portland, maybe even more so, I think. Portland still has a kind of old school quality to it, but Seattle these days is a lot of flash.
Right. Well, that,
so he runs with it once he gets there, and this leads to his crisis because he's got to figure out who he is. Is he the guy with sawdust behind his ears from Shelton, or is this persona that he's taken on?
Right. Which, I mean, I think that's a good, that's a very modern it's a very modern problem that people have. Who are you? Are you the person that you were kind of meant to be, or are you the person that you're going to make yourself into, which is kind of a classic American story where people go to LA or they go to New York or they go to Seattle and they can become somebody new.
Well, he's a version of Kurt Cobain, who came from Aberdeen, which isn't far from Shelton. Except that, instead of, alternative music, grunge, he's doing Bing, and maybe this is his blessing in the end, in that he does finally recognize that maybe he's fulfilling his grandma's dream and not his own.
Right. Well, is Bing Crosby someone that you particularly like? Is this something of yours that is you're channeling through your character, or is this something that you just somehow came upon?
No, actually, I'm not that big a fan of Bing Crosby. I have become a fan in writing this book. I mean, his biography is fascinating. He's, to me, a very iconic Washington State figure. He was born in Tacoma, and his ancestors are some of the earliest settlers here. And then he moved to Spokane when he was young, and Spokane goes crazy over him still. There's the Bing Theater and at Gonzaga University. They have a Bing house, and Bing, there used to be the Bing Student Center with the Crosby Anna Room that had all this Bing paraphernalia in it. So I just saw him as a very kind of totemic Washington State figure, but I did start to appreciate his contributions to music and the way he sang and the way he could marry the lyrics to the music is really quite phenomenal. But on the whole, no, I'm not that too excited. This story it does have a little autobiographical in that, you know, he's dating a woman who has a child, and that's part of that leads to some of the decisions he has to make about himself.
Right. Well, I am something of a fan of Bing Crosby, although not in a, you know, kind of deep way, but I've always admired his movie work. I think that he, you know, there's a certain, you know, him and a certain of his contemporaries had this sort of easiness about them and comfort in being themselves in their acting and stage and singing identities, which you sort of feel comes through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always, it's always interesting to see the difference between the people who are inhabiting themselves and comfortable in their own skins and people who are suffering. And that's their, you know, the power of their work is the transformation that occurs because of their suffering. It's kind of like, the difference between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, or the difference between Sinatra and Crosby, that really comes across. And, you know, it's not that one is better than the other. It's just that it's an interesting contrast to look at. And so, and as you said, very few people, I think, today, unless you're old enough, have any concept of Crosby. And even if you are older and you've heard it, I mean, we, you know, at least for me growing up, we tried to dismiss that music. That was not what we were interested in. But it's, you know, it is still pretty compelling to imagine that period.
The music seems utterly corny to us now. And, you know, they were all at the time feel good songs. And he came in for some criticism for that, you know, singing these kind of saccharine love songs during the 30s and the Great Depression that are pretty escapist. Dreaming my troubles away, as one of his songs goes. My character tries to tap into that kind of ease that Bing Crosby character, as you identified, has with him. So when he's confronting issues, you know, he has his "what would Bing do" kind of mode,
right?
And tries to channel that coolness,
right,
that Bing had. One of my favorite Bing movies is I can't remember the titles, but it's the one where he's totally out of character and he's the alcoholic trying to make a comeback on the stage, and his life is just a mess.
Well, it is, you know, he tried to get outside of his character, you know, maybe he couldn't do it. I don't know. But maybe that's true of all, you know, most actors and singers. It's hard to, be somebody, you know, to extend the character essentially. But I think these three novels work really well together. And, you know, I do think that it's I think that the placement of them in the Northwest is really interesting. And of course, I think, I don't know, you know, you live there, and so it's different for people who live there. But for people like me who have probably not, most people have not spent a lot of time on the Olympic Peninsula, I think it's really, you know, you've captured a certain element of the culture and the place that I think is really compelling.
And I wanted to get these aspects of the history that even very few Northwesterners know about, like the Juvenile Delinquent Center. You know, the only way I found out about it is that there was a small plaque in the corner of Fort Worden that had a mention of it, and then it quoted a letter. from a mother imploring her son to be a good boy so that he could come home for Christmas. And it just tore my heart. And then I found out more that it was actually this delinquent center for 15 years. And I was just stunned to learn about this history.
Well, I think it's really, I'm glad you did. Let's put it that way. I think it's really good. I want to thank you so much for talking to me about the three sides of water, almost a defining term for peninsula. It was a really, really fun book for me to read. And thank you very much, Peter Donahue.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Peter Donahue about Three Sides Water. It's a collection of three short novels.